Our Your Vote 2018 special coverage continues. Today begins our second week of special Your Vote 2018 coverage in advance of the November election. On today's program, during the first half hour, we'll speak with Zach Ringelstein, Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate. In the second half of the program, we'll discuss which issues matter to Mainers this election cycle. What are your questions or comments? Maine Calling is next. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is a special Your Vote 2018 Maine Calling. My guest this half hour is Zach Ringelstein, Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate. What questions do you have for him? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Zach, welcome to Maine Calling. The first question, the big one, why are you running?
Thank you, Jennifer. I am running because America's government, unfortunately, has been rigged for the ultra-wealthy and for billionaires. And it's about time that working people take our country back and that we have people who are uninfluenced by big money. And so we're not taking any corporate PAC, lobbyists, or fossil fuel money. And therefore, I can stand for issues that matter to working people, like Medicare for all, like saving our planet from the effects of climate change, like raising wages and raising teacher salaries and investing in infrastructure, all the things that we deserve as the working people in this state. And with ranked choice voting, there's no spoiler effect. And so we can vote for a real progressive U.S. senator for once.
All right. Well, Zach, I'm asking all of the candidates a group of questions to each of you. The first, should access to affordable health care be a national priority? And if so, what should Congress do to ensure it?
Yes, 100%. We need Medicare for all. I tell this story about my student. So I had a student a few years ago. I was a public school teacher, and an 11-year-old walked into my room jaundiced, and she was a wonderful kid, and her family didn't have great access to healthcare and didn't know how to access the system, and she ended up, unfortunately, not getting the care she needed, not getting the diagnosis she needed, sent her to the nurse, a special education teacher, and I tried to get her the right care, and by the time she ended up in the hospital, she was diagnosed with leukemia, and then after just 3 weeks, she died. And this is the kind of thing that is happening across the board in this state, in Maine, where people don't have access to healthcare, where people are paying a second mortgage, and the mortality and morbidity is criminal. We deserve better, and we pay the most per capita of any country in the world on healthcare. That's 17% of our GDP. And the next after that is 13%. And yet we have the worst outcomes of any developed country in the world. And so we literally would be paying less if we were to convert to Medicare for all.
Is that what you advocate that Congress do?
Yes. And actually, 70% of Americans support Medicare for all, and over 50%, surprisingly, of Republicans support Medicare for all at this point. And so this is something that can be done. And the only reason it's not being done is because the pharmaceutical companies and health insurance companies fund our Congress. And so only 16 senators will support it. Angus King does not support Medicare for all. And I hate to say it, but the reason is that he takes money from pharmaceutical companies.
What, Zach Ringelstein, if anything, should be done about the partisan divide in our state and nation?
We need to get money out of politics. It's money that's the problem. And it's the reality that we are seeing the effects of a corporate takeover of our government, where we have literally big corporations that are able to fund our candidates through corporate PACs. And so we can't get anything done for the people when literally the lobbyists are writing the policies and then funding the campaigns. So they're holding a carrot over these folks' head for their reelection. And unfortunately, we're not going to get anywhere positive for this country until we take money out of politics and start to really trust that we can't truly get behind folks who are, for example, Angus King takes money from ExxonMobil. He takes money from Navient, a predatory student loan company. And listen, I like Angus, but I think it's about time we start to realize that as we get farther and farther towards the corporate and towards the far right, and Angus sits right there in the middle, that he's being taken a ride towards the corporate and the far right. The middle moves right, and that's not okay in this time. We need a U.S. Senate that is not influenced, that is not bought by big money in politics.
Zach, what is the biggest single issue facing the constituents of Maine, and how will you address it if elected?
Yeah, it's that our economy is rigged for the ultra wealthy, and this takes so many. This has so many effects on the people of Maine. The wages in the state are not growing. The second congressional district is in an economic depression that is longer and deeper than the Great Depression, and we could have so much more. We could have Medicare for all. We could raise teacher salaries and make our public schools the best in the entire world. We could invest in infrastructure, and we could save our planet through what I call a Green New Deal. And that's like FDR's Green New Deal. All of my policies, by the way, come after FDR. I'm an FDR Democrat. And the idea behind a Green New Deal is that we convert to a fully renewable energy system by 2035, and at the same time, using Maine technologies, literally technologies that are built here in Maine, we would then be able to create high-wage jobs in this economy by pushing towards a new vision of renewable energy.
On what committee would you like to serve and why?
So, of course, this week everyone wants to be sitting on the Judiciary Committee. And I think that I certainly would like to have a big say in the Supreme Court. And so that is definitely a place where I'd like to sit. I'd also like to remind folks that I was a public school teacher here in Maine just a year and a half ago. And so education is the root of my run for U.S. Senate. I believe that early education policy, if we got it right, along with healthcare, we would be able to level the playing field for all Americans. And so I would like to see the Betsy DeVos is not being able to control our public schools. And I would like to have some say over how we are able to affect children's lives. And so education is really important. And what I'll say about education is that standardized testing and the privatization movement are bringing down our education system. It's about some time someone actually tell a story about what's really going on in Washington. So I want to tell you, Jennifer, I was invited to the White House during the Obama administration, and I was really excited to be there and to talk about early education policy. And I got escorted up after meeting President Obama to a room, a beautiful room, and I was excited to dig in deep to early education policy. And as we dug in, what was stunning was that the conversation was really low level, and I asked myself why. And it occurred to me after about 15 or 20 minutes that not a single other person in that room, except for me and including the Secretary of Education himself, had ever worked in a public school. And that is the problem, is that working people are not at the table. And so I'll leave it there with judiciary and focused on education and healthcare.
We'll go to Susan, who's calling from Bath. Hi, Susan. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling with candidate Zach Ringelstein.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. So I have heard the expression. I don't think it originated with anybody from Maine, that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. It is a force that is very difficult to resist. We've seen that very, very recently, that power will trade even the veracity of sexual abuse survivors. So I would like to know how our candidate would avoid that in wielding power in the United States Senate.
That question just gave me chills. The reason is that it's the reason I'm running for office. I think that people in power have a hard time letting it go. And unfortunately, you're right, power corrupts. And so what I believe first and foremost is that nobody who is in the U.S. Senate should have any investments in the stock market, because we know that our U.S. senators are collecting lots of wealth. And unfortunately, doing these insider stock trades, which currently is legal. I also obviously believe that we should get money out of politics, and that no candidate should be able to take corporate PAC lobbyists or fossil fuel money. And when you do that, you have people who are more beholden to people. But last and really importantly, I'm a Democrat who supports congressional term limits. And I have gone out there and pledged that I will only be in office 2 terms. And I think this needs to become a federal law. Unfortunately, Susan Collins also made this pledge and didn't follow through with it. Angus said that he was only going to run for 1 term in 2012, and he's not following through with it. And so you can see that power does corrupt, and it's going to be my mission to make sure that we have real servants in Washington, not just people who are in it for the power.
All right, Susan, thank you for your question. We'll go to a voicemail question now.
Hi, this is Kim from Falmouth. Given that Maine has one of the highest tax burdens in the country and changes in the new IRS tax laws will limit deductions for state and local taxes, as well as out-of-pocket medical expenses, what will be done to relieve the very difficult tax burden on Maine citizens? Thank you.
That is a great question, and it's the fundamentals of our campaign is that we need to start taxing the wealthy where it counts instead of taxing payrolls. So we always are talking about taxing payrolls, and one of the problems with that is that your dollar that you as a teacher or as a custodian or a firefighter that you make, the dollar that you make is taxed way more than the dollar of the billionaire who hires a financial manager to move around money. And what we need to start doing in the society is taxing this unearned income. And that unearned income comes from 4 main places. And those 4 main places are capital gains, estates, financial transactions, and dividends. And so first and foremost, we need to stop it with this awful tax scam that the Trump Republicans passed through, which, by the way, is costing us $1.9 trillion. And we need to relieve ourselves of this. So one of the policies that I've actually recently suggested is creating a federal minimum teacher salary. And I released it in Forbes, and it's a federal minimum teacher salary of $60,000. And it sounds like a lot of money. Teachers making $60,000 minimum. But think about, first of all, how amazing that would be for our public schools, that teachers would finally get their worth and we could retain and attract the best teachers in the world. But second of all, do you know that if we paid for this as a federal government, literally that $1.9 trillion from the tax bill could pay for it for the first 10 years? And so what I'm talking about is relieving the burden of the state and local, paying $60,000 from the federal government, not unheard of, and actually then giving local and states the opportunity to not only cut taxes, but invest in other things, not just schools.
Well, to follow up to that, Zach, your plan would cost the federal government about $200 billion a year. Where does that money come from?
Which plan?
That to pay the teachers $60,000 a year minimum.
Yeah, so it comes from what I just said, which is taxing unearned income, financial transactions, as well as getting rid of this tax bill.
And that adds up to $200 billion a year?
So, well, it depends on what you tax. So if you just literally, if you just tax a cent of financial transactions, you end up with billions and billions of dollars. But when it comes to this plan, the $60,000 federal minimum teacher salary, all you have to do is get rid of the tax bill and we can pay for it. And so we're always talking about our war budget and we don't even have conversations with that about it. We are always talking about these tax bills. No one even gets to have a say and we just let these things go through. But when it comes to actually helping working people, we're always like, where does the money come from? I'll tell you where the money comes from. It comes from actually doing what we need to do, which is have progressive taxation.
We are listening to a special Your Vote 2018 Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. My guest this half hour, Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate, Zach Ringelstein. Give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. Here's an email from Michael. Would you support a revenue-neutral carbon tax to help address climate change? If not, what would you propose to address climate change?
Great question. I think it's a great first step towards us making sure that we can limit and eventually completely curb our emissions of carbon. I'm sure many of you saw the study that came out yesterday. Jennifer, I'm sure you saw it. It's frightening because it basically says that there are going to be catastrophic consequences if we don't mitigate the effects of climate change now and by mid-century convert to 100% renewable energy. And so it's very important that we move in this direction, but I think we need to go even bigger and actually create a deadline, which I think should be 2035. And that's the Green New Deal that I spoke of earlier. And just like in any other big effort that we've undertaken, whether it was sending a person to the moon or World War II, when we go ahead and move forward with an initiative like converting to a fully renewable energy system by 2035, and we all get unified and on board to fight this, guess what? The economy grows by leaps and bounds, and that's what we need to do.
We'll go to another voicemail question.
This is Jeff from Biddeford, and what are one or two specific measures you would support to ensure the long-term financial solvency of Social Security?
So first and foremost, we need to make sure that Social Security cannot be touched. We are living in a time when obviously it is on the chopping block, and the Republicans would like to see it on the chopping block, and I think that is very scary. What I want to make sure of is not only that we make sure that Social Security cannot be touched, but I also want to see us stop getting taxed on our Social Security. So a lot of people don't know this, but it was in the Reagan administration that your Social Security income started getting taxed. You earned that money over the course of your career. You not only should get to keep it, but you shouldn't be taxed on it by the federal government.
We have Mary on Facebook asking, I'd like to hear Zach Ringelstein talk about why Democrats should vote for him over Angus King. Angus is popular. Why should we change?
I think Angus is always sitting on the fence. And listen, I like Angus. And what I am saying is you should vote for me, one, and rank Angus, two. And here's why. Angus is a good senator, but not a great senator, because he takes money from pharmaceutical companies and therefore doesn't support Medicare for all. He is a good senator, but not a great senator, because he takes money from ExxonMobil and just recently introduced a gas pipeline bill to the U.S. Senate that fast tracks these gas pipelines and bypasses community and tribal rights. He's a good senator, but not a great senator, because he takes money from TD Bank and from Goldman Sachs and recently co-sponsored the bill to deregulate Wall Street less than 10 years after the 2007 crash. He's a good senator, not a great senator, because he takes money from Navient, which is a predatory student loan company. And he voted against military sexual assault prevention legislation. He endorsed Susan Collins in 2014, and he's voted with Trump almost half the time. That's not bold leadership. In 2018, we need bold leadership, people who are ready to fight for what's right in this country. And I'm willing to do that, and I'm the only person in this race who's not bought and who stands for Medicare for all, who stands for a Green New Deal, who stands for reinvesting in our infrastructure and truly raising wages. And with ranked choice, we can vote our hopes. We don't have to vote our fears, because there is no spoiler effect.
We'll go to Lori, who's calling from Otisfield. Hi, Lori. Go ahead.
Hi, Mr. Ringelstein. Would you support amending the Constitution to get rid of Citizens United? And how would you do it? Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, 100%. So it is very tricky, especially now that Kavanaugh is in the Supreme Court. But what I would say is that there's a little glimmer of hope recently, because there was a decision that was made in a lower court and that Justice Roberts ended up upholding. And that was that basically all the dark money that's flowing through PACs in the 2018 election now needs to be exposed. And so we know that Citizens United is a consequence of years and years of corporations, multinational corporations, truly taking over our government and even taking over our independent judiciary. And so we need to do all that we possibly can to not just force this issue publicly, but also to elect people who are willing to make this their signature issue.
Lori, thanks so much for your call. We will go to another voicemail call for Zach Ringelstein.
Holly from Vassalboro. The U.S. incarceration system is unfair, unjust, and expensive. Congress can change this system of mass incarceration by passing the Bipartisan Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act. My question is, will you support legislation such as this Sentencing Reform and Correction Act to reduce mandatory minimum sentences, give judge more discretion, and to lower the federal prison population?
Yes, a free and just society cannot have the amount of prisoners in our prison system that we do. Many people know that I went down to the border to McAllen, Texas, the place where Trump created the detention centers at the height of the crisis. And when I was down there, I ended up trying to deliver toys, books, and supplies to kids. And they actually arrested me and threw me into Texas prison. And I got a really good inside glimpse of our prison system. And it was startling because as a public school teacher, what I noticed was how many correctional officers there are. And I looked at it and the ratios, the student to teacher ratio is 16 to 1. And the inmate to correctional officer ratio is 4 to 1 in this country. Talk about backwards priorities. We need a moral budget. So when anyone asks me, how are we going to pay for public education? I say stop for-profit prisons. I talk about reducing mandatory minimums and ending the ridiculousness of these bails. We have truly an unjust system. We jail the most people of any country in the world by a long shot, and that is not just. You cannot have freedom when that is happening. And I like to remind people that this is a startling fact, but there are more black men who are imprisoned in America today than were enslaved in the 1850s. That is unjust. This is America. We can do so much better.
We'll go to Cecile, who's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Cecile. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Cecile. I am an 18-year-old girl. This will be my first election voting. And I wanted to ask Zach, I think he's really inspired a lot of young people here in Maine to get more involved. What inspired you, Zach, to get involved in politics at such a young age? And how can other young people get involved as well?
Cecile, you just gave me chills. Thank you. You are why I'm doing this. It's because we need change. The old guard needs to step aside, and we need to take it back for our kids, for our planet, for our country, for our freedoms, for our justice. And so I'll tell you that I am doing everything I can because, honestly, I grew up working class. I qualified for free and reduced lunches growing up. I'm the son of a social worker, the youngest of four brothers. I have two brothers in the Navy. I became a public school teacher. And when I saw the other side of things, well, for example, when I got invited to the White House and saw the way that the system was completely rigged, and then I realized that 1% of our country owns about half of our wealth and 1 in 5 children are living in poverty and half of Americans can't afford a $400 emergency, it occurred to me that truly, structurally, it's rigged. And that we are literally being taken advantage of every single day. And so it's just a fight for justice. And listen, every single Mainer, I don't care if you're 8, 18, 28, 38, you keep going up. But every single Mainer has an opportunity to change things. A group of Maine activists went to the Hart Senate building. They traveled overnight on a bus last week. And I'm running for U.S. Senate. I would be the first millennial in the U.S. Senate. And you, Cecile, are our future. So I just ask you to speak up for justice, get involved, and make sure to bring all of your friends out to vote. It's so important. I'm just going to make one quick plug. We're going to have a festival that's going to be headlined by the rapper Spose, the Voter Registration Festival, on October 27th in Portland. And we'd love for you to be there, Cecile. Bring all your friends.
Cecile, thanks so much for your call. We'll go to another voicemail call now.
My name is Cheryl from Augusta, and my question is, what might the candidate do to alleviate the burden of student debt, which financially cripples so many Maine graduates? Thank you.
What a great question. So this is a huge problem that is not being taken care of, again, because of predatory student loan companies that have bought off Washington, including Senator Angus King. And it needs to be solved very, very quickly because it's becoming a crisis. The millennial generation is actually not, they're buying homes at lower rates, are investing in the stock market at lower rates, and starting companies at lower rates than their previous generations. Why? Because they're saddled with student debt. We are saddled with student debt. My wife and I graduated college with over $150,000 of college debt. How in the world are you supposed to get a down payment or start a life here in Maine or in America with that kind of debt? And so what I believe is we need to do two things. First of all, we need to save the young people, and we need to create a system of tuition-free public colleges. I like to remind people that for what we added to the military budget this year, $82 billion, we could do that, okay? The second thing I think we can do is we can start to forgive college debt, first through service programs. So if you want to be a teacher in rural Maine, or you want to serve our country, or if you want to be a nurse, or find a way to serve in many capacities, what we'd love to do and what we should be doing is forgiving college debt because you are doing your service. The other thing, which I like to remind people, is that the total debt in this country is $1.4 trillion. And again, the amount that that tax bill cost was $1.9 trillion. So if we really want to compare it, we have an opportunity to forgive all debt. And I want that conversation to continue to happen.
All right. And that is our last question for this half hour. Thank you, Zach, for joining us today. Zach Ringelstein, the Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate. Sandra Harris ran the board this half hour, and you can find all of our 2018, Your Vote 2018 interviews at mainepublic.org. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at 8. When we come back, a conversation about the issues likely to be top of mind for Maine voters on Election Day. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling.
A year after Harvey Weinstein and Me Too, New York is enacting the country's strictest workplace sexual harassment laws.
You want to have training that goes well beyond sexual harassment. You want it to cover discrimination and harassment based upon any protected category, not just sexual harassment.
That story, plus Justice Brett Kavanaugh's first day on the Supreme Court, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us this afternoon from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. Starting at 4:30 each weekday evening, Maine Public Television brings you 3.5 hours of in-depth quality public affairs programming. First at 4:30 each afternoon, it's the newly expanded Amon Poor & Company, delving into the top issues of the day, followed by The Journal from Deutsche Welle at 5:30, with an international and European focus on world events and issues. Next comes the BBC World News at 6 o'clock, then the Nightly Business Report at 6:30, and finally the PBS News Hour at 7 o'clock, 4:30 to 8, each weekday evening. News you can trust on Maine Public Television.
On the next Fresh Air, how terrorists, governments, political campaigns, and even street gangs are using social media to push propaganda, disinformation, and fear with real-world consequences. We talk with P.W. Singer and Emerson Brooking, authors of the new book, Like War, The Weaponization of Social Media. Join us.
Coming up tonight at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Are you interested in traveling to Sicily? Maine Public Travel is headed to Sicily next May on another of our cultural explorations to this fascinating island. You're invited to join Morning Edition host Erwin Gratz and other friends of Maine Public. Our Many Flavors of Sicily 10-day tour will involve sightseeing, tours, lectures, and music that will offer insight and understanding of Sicily and its people. Learn more about Maine Public's Sicily tour by visiting our website, mainepublic.org. Thanks. In Maine weather this afternoon, northern and mountain sections will be cloudy with just a few showers in the far north, central and down east areas clearing skies, and southern sections mostly sunny, warm and humid, with high 61 to 80 degrees north to south. In Bangor, 64, Caribou, 52, Portland, 71. You make your vote 2018 programming possible, as do AARP Maine, advocating on the issues that matter to Mainers over 50 and their families, and reminding you to be the difference this November and vote. And Lambert Coffin, advocating for individuals and businesses in Maine trial courts and administrative agencies, online at lambertcoffin.com. And MEMIC, with the mission of sending millions of dollars back to the Maine economy as part of their plan to make safety pay. Learn more at MEMIC.com.
From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rook, and this is a special Your Vote 2018 Maine Calling. My guests this half hour are going to talk about issues they think will be at the forefront this election. Lori Parham is the state director for AARP Maine. Pam Plum is the co-chair of the Maine Revives Civility Project. And joining us from our Augusta studio is University of Maine at Farmington political science professor Jim Melcher. Which issues matter most to you this election cycle? Does one issue stand above the rest? Join our conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here. Lori Parham, I'm going to start with you because you guys actually did a survey. And what did you find out that voters 50 plus care about this election cycle?
Well, hi, Jennifer. It's great to be on the show. We released a survey in early September of voters 50 plus in Maine. This included AARP members, but was a broader survey of voters 50 plus in Maine. And we found when we asked about the different issues that were top of mind for them and that they'd be looking to see where candidates were coming down on those issues, healthcare overwhelmingly was the strongest issue. Not only adequate and affordable health care, but lowering health care costs. And this was for people 65 and older, so those who are Medicare age, but also for people age 50 to 64.
All right. And Jim, I'm going to turn to you because someone might say, well, that's just voters 50 plus. But in Maine, that is the majority of voters, isn't it?
Well, it is. And Maine has the oldest median age in the country. They're always a significant group of people. I don't know that seniors necessarily vote as a block in Maine. I think they're an ideologically diverse group of people. But I think those are issues that a lot of people care about. Healthcare is a perennial major issue, either from a perspective of new ways for government to be involved in it or people who think government is involved in it too much already. So I think young voters don't tend to think as much about healthcare, tend to think that, oh, that's something that I'll have to deal with in the future, though some obviously do. I would say young voters probably would rank a little higher things like abortion on either side of the question, the environment and student debt. But healthcare is important to everybody, and no matter who you talk to, it's going to come up.
Pam Plum, you've been spending the last year and a half or so with the Maine Revive Civility Project. Tell me how the whole idea of civility plays into this election. Do you believe that people are more likely to vote for someone who seems to be civil? Or do you think that this is something not really for the election cycle, but for year-round way, just changing the way we converse?
Right. I would say overall it's a larger picture than just the election picture. But the elections give us a wonderful opportunity to look at how we dialogue with each other around difference of opinion. An election is about people who differ with each other on how they want to solve certain problems or what they think are the biggest problems. And so the question is, how do we have that debate? And I think we should talk about how we do that debate here in these elections.
I'm thinking about campaign ads. Some of them are very negative, but there are also some candidates. Terry Hayes is popping to mind, who are running positive, even funny ads. Do those work?
I am not a specialist in whether or not they work, but my guess is that people would be more comfortable with them. And I do have some strong thoughts on the subject of negative advertising. which I think people use because it works, and they wouldn't use it if it didn't work. And so if we collectively as an audience chose to not pay attention to negative ads, then they wouldn't work anymore.
Jim, I'm curious, how many people out there, I'm sure there's been research done on this, how many people out there are single issue voters? And how, you know, you mentioned abortion for one. And how many people out there vote on more of a gut feeling about whether they like a candidate?
Well, personality is always a major factor in voting for candidates, particularly the further down you go. If you're talking about someone running for city council or town select person or even state legislator, people are often willing to put aside party, put aside ideological differences with somebody they personally know and trust. And as you go up the ladder more, you get more of those sorts of single issue voters. And the issues people care about as single issue are often things like abortion that tend to come up more at a national level. We know there was a Gallup survey 6 years ago that said one voter in six is a single issue voter on abortion. It was divided about evenly between people who said, I will only vote for a candidate who is pro-choice, and another half saying, I am pro-life. I suspect those numbers have grown. I suspect that we would also see similar numbers on some other issues, such as Second Amendment issues, but especially on issues like abortion that people tend to think of as a yes-no kind of question. You're on our side or not. Something like taxes is harder to be a single-issue voter on because there are so many shades of opinion in between them. But we know that straight ticket voting is rising. It seems logical also, especially as the environment is getting more and more polarized, that single issue voting is on the rise, but probably a minority on any given issue.
Lori, I'm looking at the AARP survey right here in front of me, and the questions are about the key electoral issues, ensuring there's adequate and affordable health care, lowering health care costs, strengthening and reforming Social Security. This doesn't ask which plan you favor to do those things, but whether they're important issues to you. Do you have a sense of voters 50 plus having a view about which way to strengthen these is the one that they prefer?
So one thing that we found in this survey is that different from prior surveys we've done in election cycles, the sense of urgency around protecting Medicare and Social Security has really grown. So even for people 50 to 64, and maybe it makes sense because they're hoping the programs will be there for them, they're saying to us, we need to address solvency issues and we need to do it sooner rather than later. The majority saying in the next 2 years. The top issue under Medicare that came up in terms of bringing down costs and in terms of the overall system was prescription drugs. The overwhelming majority of people surveyed think we need to tackle that issue. And they also believe that our members of Congress are too influenced by drug companies. So this is an issue we see that's really important.
And Jim, do you see this being addressed in the campaigns? I mean, we just had Zach Ringelstein on Maine Calling in the first half hour of this program, and he was talking about Angus King receiving money from drug companies.
Well, I mean, which question about drug companies or about Medicaid in general? I'm not quite sure I follow.
Well, do you feel as the candidates in general, the candidates for statewide office, are addressing these very issues that Lori is finding in the survey?
I tend to think people have been shying away from them. I think people running for office tend to see them as dangerous. I think it's easier for any challenger, whether it's Zach Ringelstein or Eric Brakey or anybody else who's running from the outside, to talk about the things that they would do. I think in Mr. Ringelstein's case, it's part of a more comprehensive critique about money and politics. And that's really been his theme that ties these together. And I think it brings up a key point. The same issue might be framed differently by different people. If you take an issue like global climate change, environmentalists will tend to look at that one way. Other people who say, well, no, I'm more concerned about regulation, will see that as an economic issue, as a business issue. And the question of drug company influence can be seen as either a healthcare issue, which I really don't think we're getting a lot of clarity about, and a money and politics issue, which we've seen from Terry Hayes talking about money and politics. We've seen from Ringelstein. We've seen a lot of people. I'd say the money and politics piece is really what people are talking about more in campaigns.
All right. We'll go to Dennis, who's calling from Mercer. Hi, Dennis. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Yes. Hi. I'm wondering if the panel's thoughts on sort of a newly forgotten issue. And that would be deficit spending. The large deficit spending we're seeing during boom times and at a time when interest rates are low to be repaid when interest rates will be high. I'm just curious if they think that is an issue that's still salient with voters.
It certainly comes up more. This is Jim Melcher. It comes up more in national politics than state politics, where the state is so much more constrained about having deficits. Nationally, it seems to be something that is mostly talked about as a way to attack the other party. Republicans criticize Obama for increased national debt. Now Democrats want to hit Trump on the issue. I can't say that we've really seen anything like we did 20, 25 years ago in this campaign along the lines of the Concord Coalition or balanced budget amendments or those sorts of things. It seems to be more a club people use to attack the other party as much as anything, I'm sorry to say.
Dennis, thanks for your question. We'll move on to Lewiston, where Adam is calling. Adam, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I have a multi-part question. What would you recommend needs to be done to get more Mainers to go out and vote? And then the other part of that is, being that Maine is the oldest state in the union, how do candidates running for office this year try to appeal to young people who are known not to vote and just stick to the issues of the older generation? Thank you.
Okay, Pam?
Sure. It seems to me to, on your question on how to get more people out to vote, I think is to encourage more people to be engaged in this whole process of the election instead of tuning it out. And I think one way to keep people from tuning out all of the crazy advertising and so on is to actually have conversations about what the issues are, whether that's in a, you know, sort of pop-up coffee house setting or whether it's in your living room, doesn't matter. But the more we can engage in conversation around what the issues are and what our feelings are about those issues in a sort of constructive manner, the more people will say, oh, well, I do have opinions on this. I do want to be engaged.
All right. And Jim, you teach young people. We know that young people have the lowest voter participation rate. How do we change that?
Well, that's always been true. Ever since the 26th Amendment was passed in 1971 that gave 18-year-olds the right to vote, that's always been the case. So this isn't an entirely new phenomenon. It can be somewhat confusing. I think young people often feel like the issues they care about don't come up. Things like student debt, things like the environment are not things that we're, you know, future job growth in Maine are things they feel they haven't been hearing. But to play devil's advocate a bit, there's less room for growth in Maine than most places. Maine has perennially one of the highest voting rates in the country. We have same-day registration. A lot of the things that could produce growth among young voters who are often not registered to vote and others are things that Maine's already doing. So as much as Maine would be better off having more people participate and valuing their opinion, our room for growth is limited. I think valuing young people's opinions matters. We'll often see towns say, we don't want the college students in our town participating. We don't want them doing that. In a state that desperately needs young people, I think that attitude is unfortunate. And I think that's something that could definitely change and be helpful. But we're already following a lot of the best practices here.
Lori, what are the voting rates for people 50 plus in Maine?
Oh, I'm proud to say that Maine ranks in the top five in the country for people over 50 getting out to vote. But we do even see amongst people over 50 a drop off during non-presidential election years. And that's why we've been really encouraging folks to get out and vote, people of all ages. And I'd suggest that as we travel the state, and I've been on the road and we're holding community conversations around healthcare and then more generally around the issues, that there is a lot of overlap. And in the work we're doing with our age-friendly communities, a lot of that work is multi-generational. And so when you're talking about connectivity and broadband, that crosses generations. Healthcare crosses generations. Mm-hmm. Retirement security. Student debt is not just an issue for folks who have just come out of college, but boomers still have student debt. Grandparents and parents are helping to pay for their children's college. So a lot of the issues really cross the generations.
Pam, you were going to jump in.
I was going to jump in on how to engage young people in the debate. And I would suggest strongly a couple of things. One, take this debate to them in the school systems. You know, do we still teach civics in our schools? I'm not sure. Do we have debates at high schools on key issues that are in front of the public at election time? I suggest we go right to where the young people are early on and engage them.
You're listening to a special
and
Your Vote.
Hold on
just a second, Jim. I'm just going to give people the phone number here if you'd like to join the conversation about issues important to Mainers. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Okay, go ahead.
I just want to reinforce that point about being able to debate and to talk about things in a civil way. As somebody who teaches courses in American government, most of my courses have some kind of debating. And I'm always very impressed with how well my students are able to handle difficult questions on same-sex marriage or, you know, a few years ago, certainly, or other controversial things. And when you look at people face-to-face and get used to talking to them that way, you learn to make debates about issues as opposed to ad hominems, as opposed to personal attacks. So I completely agree that it getting people experienced in how to discuss questions in an era when on social media you're often arguing with people you can't see. You see comments in newspapers where people's names aren't present there. I think some of what we need to teach better in this country is how to have a disagree, to quote Barack Obama, to disagree without being disagreeable. And I completely agree that more of that in high school would be an excellent first idea.
We'll go to Owen, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Owen. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi. Yeah, just to what you were saying a second ago about engaging young people, I think that a lot of it, and you saw this in the presidential election, is to do with young people not necessarily caring about one issue or the other issue and being single issue voters, but having this like broad disillusionment when you try to engage us in schools, but we look around us and see huge income inequality. So what people are looking for there is someone who's really just going to tax the heck out of the rich. And, you know, there's not a lot of people on either side who are going to do that. So I think you have to look at that broader issue of socialism in general and opening up to it if you want to engage young people. So thanks.
Go ahead, Pam.
I agree that it would be very useful for us to begin in school systems or in clubs outside of school, teaching kids how to talk about these issues and how to engage them and how to give them the data that they need to know what all the issues are. The caller was saying they would tend to be single issue. Well, depends on how much information they have and how much engagement they have and what all the issues are.
All right. Thanks, Owen, for your call. Go ahead, Jim.
I'd echo not only that, but I want to talk about what the caller talked about along the lines of disillusionment. He seemed to suggest it was kind of on one end of the spectrum, talked about socialism as a way to get people away from being disillusioned. I see it among students, a sense of disillusion, apathy that isn't really just the province of one end of the political spectrum. I think it's much more general than that. And I don't know that one set of positions or one ideology would produce that. I have students working in a class right now where they volunteer in campaigns. And some of them have been frustrated as they try and talk to students about things that they are seeing them one-on-one. They are trying to engage them. Where a lot of students say, well, I don't really care about that or that doesn't interest me. I think disillusionment goes all over the political spectrum among young people. And I think getting them to do things that raise their efficacy in politics is some of the way to go on that.
We have an email from Mike, a question for Pam Plum. In my opinion, Donald Trump represents the flaming antithesis of civility. Recent displays, heckling Senator Elizabeth Warren as Pocahontas before a cheering crowd of supporters, denigrating journalists as the enemy of the people, mocking the victim of sexual assault with all the finesse of a schoolyard bully. What message does this behavior communicate to the children of America? That's the email from Mike, and I want to follow up with you, Pam. Is it particularly difficult now to have discussions about civility?
Certainly we have a situation where civility is not at its high water mark in the political scene right now. But I think it gives us a great opportunity to call attention to that and to call attention to the fact that there are other ways that we can debate these issues, other ways that we can treat the people with whom we disagree, listen to the people with whom we disagree, and have a dialogue. And I guess particularly on this issue of civility, I have this little spiel on democracy, which I will give you, and that is democracy was created to bring together people who disagreed with one another and get them to come to some kind of solution that was satisfactory to the largest number of people. And that's the core. And if we can't do that, if we can't talk to each other well enough to come to those compromises, come to those agreements, it's not going to be democracy anymore.
And Lori, this is something your survey touched on, political divisiveness.
Yes. More than 50% of voters 50 plus surveyed said that political divisiveness is a top concern. We're actually collaborating with Maine Revive Civility, and we've held some workshops that folks have come out to, not just with our volunteers, but with members who are interested. And they've found the conversations really useful, really helpful. But it's taking those conversations and those tools back into your day-to-day life, whether it's the conversation you have with a neighbor, someone at the office. But again, as we talked about earlier, so much is done on social media and not face-to-face, that the more we can get people talking to each other, I think the better off we're going to be.
Hear, hear.
We'll go to Barbara calling from Scarborough. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thank you. Well, I think this is a topic to, it's not a sort of platform thing, but it's a procedural thing. Can you remind us all about the scope of ranked choice voting in this election, where it applies, where it doesn't apply, the opportunity it offers us to look more deeply at the people who are running for office?
Sure, Barbara. Thank you for that question. I should let you know that tomorrow on the program, our Secretary of State, Matt Dunlap, is going to answer all sorts of election questions. But, Jim, you know the quick answer to Barbara's question, don't you?
The fast answer is, according to the state Supreme Court, or Supreme Judicial Court, rather, we can't have ranked choice voting in a general election for governor or for state legislators. So in voting in the governor's race, you won't be able to use it. You will be able to use it, however, in our congressional elections this year. And this will be the first time that's ever been present anywhere in the country to have ranked choice voting on candidates for Congress.
All right. Well, Barbara, thank you. And listen tomorrow. Matt Dunlap will answer all sorts of questions about the election. We're going to go to Stephen in Portland. Hi, Stephen. Go ahead.
Hi. Good afternoon. I'm 24 years old, and I've been following the candidates very closely this election. But one of the issues is that they've been talking about addressing the labor shortage we have here by bringing in, like, refugees. The only thing about that, we should bring in refugees who are going to work really hard and not strain our public service system. So if we're going to bring in refugees like to address the labor problem, we should have them probably report every 3 to 6 months on their job progress and how they're doing.
And Stephen, is this the issue that you're listening for when you listen to the candidates talk and when you see their campaign ads?
Yes, I'm a swing voter. I'm independent. I'm not Democrat or Republican, but we don't want more strain on the public service system. We're already strained financially on it. So if we're going to bring in workforce, we want to have productive workforce, not workforce that's going to strain the system.
All right. And I'll turn to you, Jim. Do you think that Stephen's has a common concern, or do you think he's a little unusual as a voter?
I don't think it's the lead issue for most voters in the sense of those finer points about immigration that he was making, but certainly about nationally, immigration as a question is certainly something that separated Donald Trump both from members of his own party. Trump has talked about proposals making immigration based more on skill than family reunification. So that would speak to that. But in Maine, we've had this issue about asylees, for example, people seeking asylum, often very well educated, very highly skilled people, and the LePage administration being more resistant to that. So I think in maybe not on that fine and detailed level, but I think that is an issue that people care about at some level, both in national politics and here in Maine.
And Lori, that's what AARP found in the survey, that jobs and the economy are an issue 72% of people care about. But if I'm looking here, and I know I just have a summary sheet here, immigration was not one of the issues that the people you surveyed brought up as a top issue.
No, they did not bring it up as a top issue. Workforce is a top issue. And we talk a lot about the need to develop proposals to bring young people to Maine. And while I wouldn't disagree with that, we have a large workforce of people over 50 who have a lot to give and a lot to offer. And so in our conversations with policymakers and with the chambers, it's really looking at all of the different kinds of workers, new immigrants, young people, veterans, people over 50. If you look at most recent studies, a multi-generational diverse workforce is really best for the economy.
I would support that. And I'd also say that we need to look carefully at how we're preparing people in Maine to go into the workforce, whether those are kids coming up through high school or whether those are immigrants who come in at whatever age. We need to be sure we're actually training people to do the jobs that are available.
All right. Well, you're going to have the last word. That was Pam Plum, one of the three guests today as we discuss issues on the top of mind on from the November election. That was Pam Plum, co-chair of the Maine Revives Civility Project. Lori Parham is the state director for AARP Maine, and Jim Melcher, professor of political science at the University of Maine, Farmington. Sandra Harris ran the board today. We had additional help from Mal Leary in Augusta. You can find all of our Your Vote 2018 interviews, as well as more information on the candidates and their positions, on the Maine Public website. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at 8. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.